Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sam Harris, who has a collection of essays titled Ham, Slices of a Life. This is Sam Harris, the performer, not Sam Harris, the atheist. He started out on Star Search. He was in several shows on Broadway and on tour, including Grease, Jesus Christ Superstar. I saw him years ago in a show called The Life, Cabaret, Hair, Pippin, Jazz Singer, First Wives Club. He was on the CBS sitcom The Class. Sam Harris, this is your first book. Of course, you have been writing. You did co-write a CBS sitcom called Down to Earth. You produced shows for various people, including one of your best friends, Liza Minnelli. But this is different. Let me start by asking you, what prompted you and when to write the first essay that became part of Slices of a Live Ham?
I had always been, like you said, writing for different medium and thought about a book, but it sounded really large. But I had written the occasional essay here and there, and my friend Frank Langella, who had written a book that was released in the spring of 2012, said, Sam, you need to be writing. You really need to be writing. He'd read a few little things I had written, and he said, you need to be focusing on this, but without expectation. Just write. You know, in my business, you're talking about all the various things that I've done. Everything is about going and selling and pitching and doing. And he said, you need to just write without thinking about what it's going to be or where it's going to go. And I did. And I don't recall what the first one was, but I'm sure it was a childhood one. As you know, the book is non-chronological. It's my growing up in Oklahoma. It's parenthood. It's celebrity. It's showbiz. It's all kinds of stuff. And I just started writing, and I'm a fast writer, but then I can tweak until you wrench the pages from my hand. And I started sending Frank little stories, and he said, keep going, this is good stuff, you know, go deeper here, about this and that. And he really helped guide the beginning of it. That was in April of 2012. By the summer, I had a stack of pages, I don't know, 60, 80 pages, and showed them, had the guts to show them to a few people who were pleased with what I had done and suggested a couple of book agents. And then I made several trips to New York to meet with agents who were enthusiastic. And in September, we sold it to Simon & Schuster, to Gallery Books. It was really strangely fast.
There are several celebrity essays, not that many, but a handful of them. Were those the Liza Minnelli marriage story and the Aretha Franklin and Cleveland story, were those part of that original series of essays?
I think the wedding story was. And the wedding story is something that had evolved because I used to do that story in my act, in my show, not written, of course, in the same way, but sort of acting out all the various crazy players.
When you're considering a topic, do you just sit there and go, oh, today I'm going to write about my son Cooper, or today I've got a Liza Minnelli story? Because I'm assuming that there's a lot more where these came from at this point.
There's so much more. And that's the next thing. We've got to start working on the next one. It was never my intention for this to be sort of a one-off, and certainly not a show-busy sort of celebrity tell-all. It's not that kind of book. It is truly, I mean, it's memoir by definition, but it's a collection of stories and essays. I made a list, certainly, of just memorable, for instance, childhood experiences, things that I thought were funny or that exhibited my sort of survival tools or the character that I was. And I would write down, like, the Aretha story. I had been telling that story at dinner parties for some time, for years ago. But then I would come home from, you know, the grocery store and something would have inspired something. Or there's a chapter called Liver, which is about my blind optimism in the face of all evidence to the contrary. So many of the good things that have happened in my life are because I've been so tenacious, and so nothing will stop me. And yet I have trouble separating that from things that are clearly awful. The title of that chapter is called Liver, which is based on the liver law, which is liver is liver. You can throw on little bacons, a little onions, but it's still liver. But the first, I don't know, 8 pages of that story are about a washer and dryer. A new fancy washer and dryer, and the scientific technology of it, and the lights, and the music, and the, you know, it's fascinating, it's beautiful. I sit and watch it with popcorn, you know, I photograph it, I have fantasies of people bringing their laundry over, but they suck, they don't clean the clothes or dry them properly, and then it's like, I have to look at this.
Sam Harris, now you started out on Star Search, but before that you had a deal with coming out and being gay in a small town in the Midwest. And that meant that when you were starting out, before you even did anything, there was this dark place because you had to deal with being all alone.
Yes, I certainly write about this in the book, sometimes in a humorous way and sometimes not, because at 16 years old I did attempt suicide. I had known I was different from my earliest memories, long before it had a name that specified shame. And in that time in Oklahoma, in culture, there were no role models. You know, when I was 10 years old, it was the early 70s. Thankfully, Richard, I found my means of expression, my survival tool, my little private enclave of music and showbiz and theater that saved my soul and gave me an identity. My parents didn't really, or my father in particular, didn't really understand it and was concerned about it, but they were still supportive, and ultimately he became my champion. But, you know, I left home when I was 15 because I was talented and driven, and I started getting work, and then I quit high school and finished it through correspondence courses. When I left home, when I was 16 years old, I had my first relationship. So the thing I thought could never, ever be. I mean, there was no one. There were no role models. Now, you know, we have actors, politicians, athletes, everything. I fell in love. And so when I returned to my little town, it was worse because I had tasted truth.
That was the Opryland.
That was Opryland. Opryland in Nashville, which was a fantastic training ground, by the way. We did 5 shows a day, hour long, 47,000 costume changes, an 18-piece orchestra, singing these incredible. It was the greatest training experience.
And you were 15, 16.
Uh-huh.
I can't imagine being 15, 16 years old doing that kind of stuff.
Really? I lived for it. I lived for it. I am of a breed, of an old showbiz, nearly vaudevillian, you know, breed of that the show goes on. You know, my God, the injuries I have sustained over the years because you just keep going. I loved it, and it did give me a focus.
During that period, you were also dealing with being gay. How aware were you of what was going on in places like San Francisco and New York?
I don't think I was aware of anything. Even growing up, you know, because I was born in the early 60s, and I mean, when the whole country was changing, when there were political assassinations in Kent State, but in my town, it was a bubble, and I was a smaller bubble. All this was going on, and Strange Little Sam was singing Stormy Weather in the backyard. Things didn't exist outside of that. I'm not saying that people were unaware. I'm saying it didn't affect us. We were oddly protected. Sand Springs was not going through the political and sexual revolution. So I was not aware.
And then comes Star Search. Now, when you did that, and suddenly you go from being Sam Harris, who is he, to being Sam Harris, who has a career in show business, which almost happens overnight.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you have to think about, okay, I'm gay, what now?
Again, when that hit, there was this veil. No one talked about it. Interviewers were told not to ask me personal questions. Meanwhile, I was going on stage and in recording studios, practically slitting my wrists, exposing everything about my inner soul, but yet this was off limits. I went to, you know, whatever, the Grammys, the Emmys and stuff with a beard, with a girl on my arm. It was just not talked about. And I didn't know any different. And by the way, you know, Richard, this is show business history. It's not like, I mean, in the studio system, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, it was protected. This was not new. So it's all that existed. It's all that I knew. And that's what I did until I said, I'm not doing this anymore.
When you reach that point and you suddenly cross over into celebrity, I've talked to some celebrities, and what they say is, on some level at that point, the only people you can really trust are other celebrities because they're not looking at you and grabbing. Did that happen to you?
I find that there's an understanding between people who are in show business for the long haul, the survivors. But unlike some celebrity friends that I know, I have really tried to surround myself with truth tellers and people who will lay it out and will celebrate my successes and also comfort me when it's not happening. In show business, you know, it's so fickle. You get a great table because you were just on a TV show, and then it's canceled, and you're waiting for 3 hours. Because they feel like it's contagious. Your success is contagious, so they want to be around you. When it's not happening, then, oh, my God, I don't want to catch that. So I've learned to live in the middle. And I think what also helped me a lot was getting sober, which has been 10 years now, you know, where the highs and lows simply don't exist anymore in the same way. Whether I'm writing or singing or acting, or it's what I do. It is not just who I am. You know what I mean? There's a separation. I have a child. I have a husband. I have like a real life. I am not nearly as precious as I used to think I was. You know, my God, the needs that I have for structure and routine because I'm so terrified that I'm not going to be able to come through. Those go out the door when you have a kid. You know, I'm making pancakes at 6 o'clock in the morning and relegating how much television and doing homework and playing football. I never played football, Richard. You never stop auditioning. And I don't mean just literally. I mean, everything you do is for public opinion, especially now when social media is an open forum and people can anonymously say and do whatever they feel. But again, it's perspective. You know, you ask for something like right now, this book has come out. It's a dream of mine. I love writing. I love the craft of it. I love delving into the minutiae. I love writing fast and I love spending 3 days trying to find the right words or the right structure. I love the rhythm of it. And in this case, even though I've written, you know, for other things, there's no persona veil here. This is really real. This is the real thing. And I feel so fortunate and grateful at this time in my life to be able to put this out there. And yet, I didn't even think, oh, my God, but I actually am putting it out there. Once it's out there, it's out there. You know, I'm doing a show about it. I have a book about it. I'm talking about it. You know, as an actor, when you play a role, you substitute your personal experiences and imbue them into that role so you could have an authentic reaction. There is no substitution here. When I'm doing this show or talking about whether it's something really funny and ridiculous or it's about whatever, attempting suicide, getting sober, there ain't no substitution. I'm going to this for real every time. I forgot I was going to be doing that. And I really do love it, but it's a lot.
Well, it's also a lot of work because you're constantly having to put yourself out there rather than, as you said this morning, 9 a.m., I don't want to get out of bed.
Yeah. Well, I got to, though. I got to stay in. I'm out of town, and so I didn't get up at 6 o'clock and make pancakes.
Well, when you're doing this writing, is there any self-editing at all that goes on? Certainly, if I were to talk about my years at this radio station, a part of me would be afraid that I'd lose half my friends.
This book is not a tell-all. I don't say anything in here that somebody doesn't know about other people. What I do reveal is stuff about myself.
Is that something that you decided a while ago that you were just going to do that?
I have no interest in revealing the dirty laundry of anyone else. This is a book about me. Even the stories in which you're talking about that mention celebrities, celebrity friends, celebrity experiences, those stories are about my experience in that situation. They're not about the other person's experience or me deciding what they are or what they feel or what they did right or wrong. It's about what I got out of it. And the Aretha story, which I'm quite young and I'm, you know, requested by the great Aretha herself to open for her in Cleveland. I'm newly famous, newly on the boards. And it was the most disastrous, horrifying. It was in a blizzard in Cleveland. Everyone was late. No one was. It was awful. It was as you read it, even when I read it, I'm like, this can't be true. This can't be true. How can it keep getting worse? And yet the story ultimately is about me trying to restore what Aretha was for me and the influence she was on me and how I learned to sing certain notes and sounds from imitating her, me trying to restore my idolatry of her. I think everyone wants the person to be exactly what they perceive them as. They don't have to be.
They've got the persona, which is not necessarily who they are. I mean, when I talk to celebrities, you're an exception, but when I talk to celebrities, you could see the wall. It's a protective wall.
My protective wall is not really so much about myself. It really is about others. I'm not interested in being that kind of writer that's going to be like, here's the scoop on what this person who you think you know. It's not my style.
You're listening to an interview with Sam Harris, whose collection of essays and stories is titled Ham, Slices of a Life. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Sam Harris, at what point did you realize, you know, I'm a gay man in America, and I'm a celebrity in America. That gives me a certain responsibility. How did that come to you?
I think because after having stood up publicly on a platform demanding equal rights, there comes with that the responsibility to then be your best citizen. When marriage in California, when we had that window before Proposition 8, and, you know, I'd been on the pulpit for this for some time, and Danny and I had been together for a long time at that point, and we had a child, Cooper. Should we get married? And there was a part of me that was like, I don't need a piece of paper. I don't need for someone else to tell me that I'm equal and valuable. And the other side of that was, well, yes, because A, I've been fighting for it. We need to be counted. And C, which is what I think you're asking, is what does that obligate me to? And that obligates me. The magnifying glass is on us in history right now. More has happened in the gay movement in our lifetime. It's extraordinary. So there is a magnifying glass. Does that make my vows more precious? I'll tell you what it does is it makes me take them more seriously.
It has changed your relationship.
Definitely. I don't think I realized what true happiness was until I was married, and then it was too late. No, it does. And also as a citizen and as a parent, I think this is also true for parenting. And maybe it's gay or maybe it's not. Parenting is parenting. But, you know, when you have a kid, you have to be a model of what you want to be for them. And that doesn't just go for when you're with them. It goes for when you're not with them and you're in the car and you're pissed off at the driver who cut you off. You can't be two people. You have to be the citizen you want your child to be.
But also, this comes back to your being in this celebrity culture. There's still the fact that there are little 10-year-old Sam Harris's out there in places like Montana or Utah, you know, who maybe are as cut off as you were. And you're in a position now as an out gay man to be a role model.
You know what my best way of being that role model is? Is to be living a good life, to be being a good citizen, to talking about this very thing, to being a good parent and a good husband. The difference, though, Richard, is that person who is cut off in Montana or Utah, they are cut off, and they may live in a small town, and their bullying exists, and prejudice and bigotry. And the worst, which is bigotry under the guise of beliefs, which is completely ridiculous, that was a change that I made when I had grown up accepting that, well, they believe this, and that's their right to believe this. It is not. It is not. You may not decide that a people of any minority are less than because you believe it or because something tells you. It's not acceptable. What I was going to say, though, is while they may be cut off, what a world we live in where you do have, if you have a computer, you know you're not alone. And I think as a sober alcoholic, a gay man who struggled as a child, our worst fear for any of us in any situation is we're the only one. I am alone. No one understands. And there's no situation in which that's true. Someone has paved the road before you.
Sam Harris, you've talked a couple of times about your alcoholism. We all have issues, gay, straight, whatever, that bring these about. And there could be, you know, genetic factors involved as well.
That's what I believe.
But there's also the fact that if you're constantly going through highs and lows, the high, you don't need anything. But then comes the low. It seems to me that the trick is not to deal with the highs so much, but to deal with the lows. Is that it?
Well, I think so, except that you can't take one seriously and not the other. I can't say, oh, good, this good review is true. Look at me. Boy, they are true. And then look at the bad review and say, oh, but that's not true. That can't affect me. If I'm affected by one, I'm affected by the other. The trick is to live in the middle, accept what I can't change, and deal in an honest, real life. Yes, the highs of show business are freaky high, and the lows are freaky low.
What's the highest thing? Being on stage and getting the applause, having people come up after you? What's the biggest high, you think?
It's changed through the years. Initially, it was definitely that immediate approval. You know, there's nothing. I live on the stage. It sounds good. I live on the stage. It's so dramatic. But I do. It's where I love to be. It's where Danny always says, if I want to know what's going on in your life, I'll come see your show. when in its best form, it is the most glorious experience. And that sort of cyclical energy from an audience is really extraordinary. There is nothing like it. And then it's over. And you're, you know, in a hotel room, steaming and drinking hot tea and watching bad television like everybody else. So, yes, the highs are high. Now, I'll tell you, like with this book, what makes me feel good is when somebody reads this and is moved by it, laughs. You know, we've been talking about alcoholism and suicide. This is mostly a funny book. And comedy is tragedy with a twist, right? So what makes me feel good right now is when somebody gets something from they did laugh, or they did cry, or they say they related to it. I may have specifics in this book, but we've all had our version, you know?
I notice that there's a balance between dealing with your public life and the private life, and certainly the story of Liza Minnelli's marriage to a person who you don't name.
The man who shall go unmentioned.
When Liza Minnelli read that essay, what was her comment?
Well, she had seen the performance of me do it. I did several versions. I'd written several versions, and she read all of them. She read everything that was in the book about her. It was actually her idea to call him. She goes, can you not mention his name? And I said, how about we call him the man who's shall go unmentioned? You know, she read everything before it was published, and she was also a major. She encouraged me a lot to be writing.
How did you meet her?
We met in 1984, I believe. I had just come off of Star Search, so I was the new, you know, wunderkind. So I had this carte blanche to go backstage and meet people that I'd always wanted to meet. So I went to New York. I think it was the first time I was playing Carnegie Hall. And The Rink was playing with Liza and Cheetah. And so I could go backstage. And, you know, they both ran out like they had known me for hundreds of years. And, you know, we of that breed, of that showbiz breed, recognize each other. And even though I was just a kid in the shadow of these extraordinarily amazing, gifted, legendary performers, there was a click. And years later, when I moved to New York, that's when Liza and I became a lot thicker. And we've worked together a lot and been through a lot together.
There's nothing in here in Ham about your year in the life. You know, that was the original show that you were in it from the beginning.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with that, and what do you feel about the show now?
I think I had done Grease. I had been on the road with Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat for like 15 months or so. I just got into New York, and I think the life had been in development for years, like 7 years or something, with most of the existing cast. And they had rewritten this role of Jojo, who was sort of the Iago.
Okay,
he was like
yeah.
This villain. He connected everyone and everything, all the bad stuff. Cy Coleman, you know, the great Cy Coleman, had written these great songs. And I got a call from Barry Moss, the casting director, and said, can you come in and sing? I came in and I actually sang a medley for Cy. There's Got to Be Something Better Than This from Sweet Charity, which he wrote, and Move On, the Sondheim song from Sunday in the Park. And I warned him in advance, and I said, Mr. Coleman, I wanted to let you know in advance I have rewritten some of the lyrics of your song. He said, did you change any of the music? And I said, no. And he said, then what the hell should I care for? She's dead. Referring to Dorothy Fields. So I sang that song, and then they threw me in a room and taught me Use What You've Got and asked me to come in and sing. And then we played. It was ridiculous. It was like this jazz session. Cy Coleman was like, do you know this? And give then. And he went to the piano, and this audition, there were all these people waiting. It was like everyone disappeared, and we just started experimenting because he was still creating the show. And they offered me the role, and I had the most amazing time with that cast. Incredibly gifted people. Chuck Cooper, Lilias White, Pam, who played the primary character. She had to sing soprano and then belt her guts out and then be in jail. And she was amazing. The whole company was great. There was a funny story. I remember we were doing a song called Mr. Greed, which opened the second act, a song and dance. And Joey McNeely, who was choreographing, changed the choreography like every 15 minutes. And I'm a dancer who can sort of throw the attitude out, but I'm not like a trained dancer. And it's very mathy dance. You know, it's very mathy. And so he was changing it every day. And I'm singing my guts out. And we're in the early, the 12th version. And Cy, and I'm singing, just singing along. Cy walks in one door of the rehearsal hall. And as he's passing to the other, says, you're not going to sing it like that, are you? And then left the room. And I was like, oh, my God. Really? I'm trying to learn this? I'm trying to do... So I had a little... I said, Sai... At that point, it was Sai. And I said, can we talk, please? Can we talk? He said, sure. I am doing my best. I want to deliver everything you want. I am your servant. But please do not make comments like that in front of the company. You tell me what to do and I'll do it. But until you do, I'm going to keep experimenting. And he said, I'm sorry. I went, and it made us closer, you know? He called me his secret weapon.
The show opened. It got good reviews. I think it was a year when there were other bigger shows out there. It ran for about a year, right?
Mm-hmm. It got decent reviews. It got mixed reviews. The score is just stunning. I think the show got criticized for being too long and perhaps, I don't remember, some things that should have been refashioned, and was nominated for like 14 Tonys. I think Titanic won.
Sam Harris, Ham Slices of a Life. At what point did you decide that your book would become a show, and how did you structure the show?
Well, you know, being a showbiz ham... I knew that when the book came out, we were going to be doing promotion, that I'd be going to different places and talking about it and doing press and things. And I thought, well, what do I know how to do? What do I know how to do that's maybe different? So rather than sign books at a bookstore, I thought, well, let's create something, a piece. But I had no idea, Richard. I had no idea. What we started, Todd Schroeder, my longtime music director, and a brilliant director named Larissa Coconut. I did a workshop in Los Angeles where I read for like 2.5 hours. Threw in a couple songs, just experimenting with material. Did it for 2 nights in a small theater where people could just come and I could feel reactions. The show we have now is, rather than me reading a story and seeing a song, or this is my favorite, it has become a theater piece. It's become this linear, primarily linear, theater piece that moves like a musical where the songs actually move the plot. And we had no idea it was going to be that. And it's turned into this show. And so I'm doing it mostly in theaters. In San Francisco, I did it at Feinstein's, Nico, which is a club thing. In New York, I did it at 54 Below, which is a great, great venue, but again, a club. And they bought it. I mean, you know, New York audiences are smart. San Francisco audiences are smart. And it worked. So now we're doing it all over the place in theaters. And it's a real piece. Who knew?
What happens to a show like Broadway Man, where you're playing Al Jolson? I mean, what happens to something like that when you're busy doing this?
The Al Jolson show, which has changed titles so often, is something near and dear to my heart. The character, the writing, the brilliant writing in this show, the songs, both original and the ones that Jolson did. I relate to him. I get him. You know, he was this man with all this bravado and this showbiz thing. Talk about the show must go on. Lived for it, but highly insecure. And his inability to sort of change and grow and evolve in his time was highly detrimental, and he was the biggest star in the world. He was Michael Jackson of his time. He did everything. He was the first everything, and he had this insatiable need for the audience approval, and there's a father relationship story in it. I love this piece. It will happen someday. Thankfully, so far I'm not too old. It's on the back burner for now.
What happens when you're busy doing this and you can't get a chance to write? When are you doing your writing then?
Well, I have the list of some of the stories I want to explore, knowing that others will just pop up. In Ham, I had delivered the book, and they said, we need a few more. We need 2 or 3 more. And the last stories I wrote were Liver and the Zoo story, which is about, at the time, my 4-year-old and I have nothing in common, because he's real rough and tumble, and I'm like, you know, color code his toys. They're two of my favorite stories. I think they're two of my best work. And I wrote another piece called Hip, which is not in the book, which will probably be in the next one. So I don't know what's going to come up. I have my list. I'm experimenting. I'm doing. But right now, I'm out here with Ham.
Well, Sam Harris, how did AIDS come into the picture, and how did you deal with that? A close friend of yours passed away, the guy who got you to Star Search.
Jerry Blatt was my writer and director and mentor and friend and father figure from when I was 19 years old. He's really helped me cultivate the theme of the little white boy from the sticks with a big black voice. He saw all the components and helped put it together and created my first shows. Jerry had written, directed all of Bette Midler's shows, and not just the funny stuff, you know, the stuff that got you, the stuff that made you think and hurt. And we just were, it was an incredible collaboration. He taught me about structure. He taught me about comedy. He taught me about diffusing an audience through something funny to be able to go in with something richer. And for 10 years, he was my guide and my source. A genius. He also taught me, Richard, I think one of the great things, he taught me to find the extraordinary in the ordinary and to see the world as art. He would point out something that was something so regular and look at the beauty in it or the ridiculousness of it, the absurdity of it, which is basically what my book is. It's looking at some situation and, you know, whether it's in the book or on stage. And to answer your question, he started showing symptoms of AIDS in 1988. He moved to Amsterdam. It was so taboo. He moved to be in hiding, basically. And as he became more ill, Bette and I were the only ones who knew. We were sworn to secrecy, which is so sad, so sad. And so Bette and I would fly back and forth to see him. He died in January of 1989, and I got the call the night before saying it's time. Raced on a plane, got there, missed his passing by an hour, and felt so horrible that I had missed this moment when he had been there for every moment in my life. And I so focused on missing the moment rather than the riches of the relationship. I couldn't even find it. You know when someone so valuable to your life dies, you can't get past the end. I couldn't get to the specifics of what we had shared. This is in the book. After one of the New York memorials, one of the memorials, which was in New York, a few of us were at his apartment, reminiscing, talking, tired. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was this sudden horrible screech of brakes and crashing on the street. But it was, you know, it was New York. We were, things happened. We were exhausted. And I found myself running down the stairs. And there was this dreadful accident, awful accident. And this man crawled out of the car, covered in blood. And a few people gathered, no one with any medical knowledge. They called an ambulance. And another man and I helped pull him up. And he laid, crawled up into my arms and laid splayed across my, and I held him. And he died in my arms, this man, this stranger. And I went back up to the apartment covered in the blood of this stranger. And it was, I was then able to remember Jerry. There was no moment. There was no, you know, last minute wisdom. There was no giant moment. He died. He just died. And I thought, this is so Jerry. This is so poetic that this man I don't know is allowing me to have this experience to really be in touch with what my friend is. You know,
the funniest story, Sam Harris, of course, is lies in rehab. Your visit to her is the funny part.
Well, and the irony that I was visiting my friend in rehab and I was the alcoholic.
You were the alcoholic and she was under a false name.
Yes, she was. But prior to the night that I went in for family week, she asked me to come for family week. I spent the evening in this hotel that I can't remember, tiny little, you know, days or in something or other. And thought, well, I shouldn't, you know, there's a time change. I was coming from the West Coast to the East Coast. I need to be fresh. I need to be there for my friend because she needs me. She's, you know.
And you were the alcoholic.
And I was drinking. I'll just drink a little bit. But, you know, we don't do that well as alcoholics. So suddenly I was drinking more and more. I called room service for, could I get some more? No, we're closed. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'll come get it myself. I'll pay double. What are you talking about? And then I was so furious at the injustice that I had a great idea as an alcoholic. We have great ideas. And I snuck down the fire escape stairs, the indoor ones, in my boxer shorts and a T-shirt and scampered across the lobby when no one was there, broke into the hotel restaurant, crawling through a window to find alcohol. This is not something that normal people do. And it didn't even occur to me it was unusual behavior. And so the next day, I am in this rehab facility for family week with all the other members of families, but there's exercises and Al-Anon exercises and all this stuff. Meanwhile, I'm detoxing. I'm turning green. I can't form words. They took my freaking sleeping pills. You know, and here she is shining and fresh and clean and present, and I'm like going down this tunnel of hell. And then after the week, we went back to New York, and a man who was an addict's specialist, addiction specialist, asked me for coffee. Presumably, I thought to talk about my week there with her. And he asked me how I was. And, you know, I was shaking, I was twitching. he knew. And all of a sudden, I started telling everything about my drinking history. And he said, do you think you're an alcoholic? I said, I don't know. I've never called myself that. I've never used that word. I mean, I haven't lost my house or my car. I don't show up drunk to work. And all the justifications. And it was evident. He said, well, you'll figure it out. And we went back to the apartment. He left. We were on the street outside of the apartment building, and it was snowing. I remember it vividly. It was that quiet kind of snow, like snowflakes, like packing material, giant and quiet and sort of like this, you know, quiet for New York. And I went up to the apartment and walked in and just fell apart. And Liza said, what's wrong? Wait. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. And she held me in her arms and she said, I know, I know. And she had known. It was a gift.
But she'd been smart enough to wait for you to
come to
it out.
That's what we have to do. Yeah.
And at this point, Sam Harris, you've got the book. You've got this play you're doing now, which mm-hmm. is going around. And you're working on stories. Is there any other thing that's going on beside your home life and this that we could keep an eye on for the future?
No, I mean, I do have a couple of things coming out that I've re-recorded, some acoustic things that are going to be out, music. But this is my life. That right now, writing this book, starting the next one, being a good dad, being a good husband, making sure that I get to the soccer game and to I do a thing at school, when Cooper's school, where I go in and teach little cooking classes. That's the balance of my life.
This is a question completely out of the blue. And may not even be something you thought about.
Okay.
I'm going to throw it out there. If you were an athlete and you were planning to go to the Olympics, would you go?
It's a tricky question, isn't it? Because you plan your whole life, you work your whole life, and then something comes up that questions your moral obligation. Would I go as a gay man? If I were a gay man, an athlete, I think I would go, and I think I would be open and honest, and I think I would be counted. I don't think I would run or hide or say, I don't feel welcome here. I think I would go and say, I'm just like this guy, and I'm just like this guy. And we work together, and we train together, and we are equal human beings. Yes, I would go.
It's not that far-fetched for you as an entertainer to find yourself at some point in a position like that.
Well, and I frankly feel as if I'm in the Olympics almost every day of my life.
Well, you have to put yourself out there.
You do put yourself out there. What a blessing for me, truly. You know, here this book is a whole new thing. And when I hear that somebody's read it and has laughed or been moved by it, oh, man, it just feels so good. You know, I'm a storyteller, basically. That's what I am. Whether I'm singing or writing or acting, I'm a storyteller. Why do we like a play? Why do we like a movie? Because we relate to it. Because it's a microcosm of the human spirit.
All singing, great singing. Singing a song is always telling a story.
It's just telling a story. That's it. It's not about how you do it. It's why. What are you saying?
You've been listening to an interview with Sam Harris, whose book is titled Ham, Slices of a Life, Essays and Stories. And Sam is taking his show on the road. And keep your eyes open. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.